So much to report, so little time to report it. Welcome, my fellow thought criminals, enemies of the state, and Gitmo Nation. I have a special treat for you today. The last Monday of the month is James Corbett. The Corbett Report is his website. It's an independent, listener-supported, alternative news source operating on the principle of open-source intelligence. Provides podcasts, interviews, articles, and videos about breaking news and important issues from 9/11 truth to false flag terror, Big Brother police state, eugenics, geopolitics, central banking fraud, and more. In other words, it just would suffice to say that our friend James Corbett is a real journalist and a real reporter, staying up late with us because he reports out of Japan. Great to have you, James.
Sorry. Just woke me up there. Yes, it is midnight here in the land of the setting sun, I suppose. I'll do my best to stay awake, stay sharp.
I bored you with that intro. Is that happening?
I was like a James Corbett intro. I guess I'm rubbing off on you.
Speaking for all of my listeners, James Corbett, now awake. He realizes he's on the air. Hey, before we start on the news, I know you were reporting on this alleged Korea threat to nuke the United States. And we'll get into that here in a second. I was going to tell you this story off the air, but I want to tell it to you on the air because I think it stands for, you know, how people are waking up and how things are growing. But I had an old friend and my running partner back years ago. I'm not going to mention his name and embarrass him, but I hadn't talked to him for about 25 years, and I talked to him last year, and I found out he's a big fan of yours. And so we hadn't talked. We're not working together. One of my old friends in Seattle. And I'm finding more and more people finding work of James Corbett or people like you that I've known that I haven't talked to in a long time. So these are people that are just finding out about me, actually, that I'm doing this. And you're having a big influence on him. I know he really loves sharing your information, as do a lot of people, James. So that's neat, I think. It's nice to see that my worlds are coming back together again.
Well, I am blushing beet red to hear of that, but no, it is good. Of course, that's exactly what we want, not for myself, but for the information, and it's good to hear that. And I do hear so many stories of this getting around the world, and I just had some comments on one of my videos from Belgium, and just people popping up all around the world tuning into this information, and that's the real power of the alternative media, as you know, so it's good to hear. It's good to know.
Yeah, my friend is also a huge fan. I don't know if I should use the word fan, but he religiously checks out all of Richard Andrew Grove's stuff. So he's on to some really good information, as well as Lou Rockwell. All right, let's do this. Well, first of all, how was your 2013 so far? Pretty good?
So far, so good. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, if you want to call it that way, at least nothing catastrophic has happened yet. But we're always on that knife edge, I suppose.
Is that really how we all are? We're just waiting for the next shoe to drop?
I hope not. I certainly hope not. No, in my own personal life, I'm expecting a baby this year, our first child. So I'm definitely getting ready for that. And that's where a lot of my focus is right now, to tell you the truth.
Well, say goodbye to James Corbett's work here in just a few months.
I think it's going to change drastically, but we'll see.
You know, James, on a side note, I can't tell you how much my work has changed and how much more dedicated, I guess, I am to it since I had a little boy, you know, 9 years ago or so. And it gives you a completely different perspective on why we do all of this. Let's hit North Korea. So last week it came out, and, you know, we've been reporting on North Korea is going to get us with an EMP attack, and there's lots of fear-mongering and saber-rattling going on. I've given the audience pretty much my analysis on it, but let's hear yours. We were threatened last week with some very creative headlines that North Korea is planning to nuke us or something. Give us the breakdown on that. I know you've been reporting on it.
Well, I think that's about the sum of it. We were threatened by headlines and paper mache copies and replicas of intercontinental ballistic missiles, which is basically the some extent of what they have to throw at us. They've fashioned a couple of crude nuclear bombs that couldn't even be made into warheads. They don't even have that technology yet. So I think this type of bellicose rhetoric, the only reason it's getting any play is because obviously these are the types of headlines they want the people to hear about, because they want this to be some type of boogeyman. And this plays into a lot of people's hands in different ways. China, I think, in some ways, China likes the fact that North Korea is kind of crazy, because that that makes them the sane ones, and the people that will come to the table that that can have that respectability. So that and they have the leash on North Korea, obviously, because they provide so much aid and economic ties that that they kind of have that entire country by a leash, and that lets them be sort of the big actors there. But of course, also the U.S. and from their side, and of course all their regional allies and proxies like Japan and South Korea. Also get benefit from this because, again, it gives them that boogeyman through which they can justify the billions and billions and billions that the defense contractors are now being pumped up with through this region. So I think it plays into a lot of different agendas. And, of course, North Korea gets to pretend like it's significant, I suppose. So that's the reason why I think there's so much hype around this story right now. And I was just talking to one of my sources in South Korea today. That interview is up on my website right now, Mike Bolofsky of The Last Defense 2012 website, and he's there in South Korea, 50 miles or so from the border. And basically he's saying, I mean, this is not something that South Koreans are particularly concerned about. I mean, this is just the same type of fear-mongering rhetoric that comes around every year or two, which is just part of this cycle that North Korea uses to continue to string along the aid through which it tries to limp out and eke out some sort of existence. But the latest from StratRisk.com, North Korean cannibalism fears amid claims starving people eat children and corpses. So some more horrific stories coming out of some of the northern farming provinces there in North Korea about at least reports. Of course, they can't be verified in a country like North Korea, but more reports of cannibalism and people just going through the most atrocious conditions. So this is really what this ultimately amounts to, is a country that's just limping along and trying to act like an international player.
As usual, James Corbett answered my question before I even asked it, which was, what interest does the Obama administration have in exploiting this, or is it counter Obama? And you mentioned, you know, boosting up the military and security industrial complex. I think you were hinting at the fact that, you know, keeping our troops and our apparatus in South Korea, you always have to justify that.
Let's keep in mind there's a big expansion going on right now, and in fact there was just a report that came out last month that was showing that the biggest beneficiary, of course, of the Asia-Pacific pivot is going to be the defense contractors, and there have already been several billion dollars of contracts that have been concluded in the last year or so, including a huge one with South Korea for drones, which they're now deploying along the DMZ. So again, this directly feeds into that, and I can't remember the exact contract, but it was in the billions of dollars, and that was just concluded with a major defense contractor. So again, I mean, this is a direct thing that is happening right now.
So the contracts come before the actual event.
Well, of course. I mean, exactly right. You need an event to justify the contracts you've already signed on to, which of course is exactly what we saw with the Christmas bomber, the underwear bomber.
Well, we're going to get there in a minute. But so literally, you know, they get the ink just about dry on those contracts, make sure everybody's, you know, hands or backs are scratched, everybody's happy with these new outgoing contracts, and then you make up the event that we're about to be nuked by North Korea.
I guess they couldn't have asked for better timing on it. Certainly justifies everything they've just done.
Is this Obama, the Obama administration, that is prime behind this, or is this counter Obama? The question I asked, is this, you know, the neocons or the military industrial complex that's doing this almost counter Obama? Because in a way, it does kind of destabilize his foreign policy. In another way, it kind of helps him by, you know, playing the savior and riding on his white horse or whatever color it is. So once again, is Obama, do you believe, and keeping in mind, folks, he's just a puppet, but are his people behind this, or are they all working together, or is it just the usual suspects, the shadow government just making all this happen?
It's a good question, and I think it's important that we start taking a look at this a little bit more deeply than just talking about the U.S. government. I think, to the extent that I can surmise from what's going on here, I would say that this is more the continuity government, the shadow government, the government that never really changes, that is more behind this plan and the Asia-Pacific pivot generally. I don't think that's necessarily an Obama administration strategy. I think that's just the next focus for the next theater of war that they want to bring into existence. So I think that this is more kind of a long-term thing that's going to survive long past Obama. And I think Obama doesn't really have much, the Obama administration doesn't really have much input into this. But it is interesting to see Chuck Hagel And of course, the big being floated as defense secretary, he's going to go through the nomination process and probably survive it, I think. But we'll see in the next week or two anyway. But interesting because he has been, at least the Washington Beltway insider buzz is that, oh, he's an actual decorated war vet and he's kind of anti-bellicose neocon warmongering type war. So he might be kind of...
Well, they said anti-Israel and then some neocons are going, don't throw us in the briar patch with... with Chuck Hagel, whatever you do, you know what I mean?
It's like exactly. Well, exactly. And he's a Bilderberger, so exactly. How much is he really going to stray off the plantation? I mean, it's mostly smoke and mirrors, but it is interesting to see, at any rate, someone like this being floated, and we'll see if that has anything whatsoever to do with the change in foreign policy, but I kind of doubt it, especially with Kerry at the head of the State Department.
Right. Well, I'm going to get into that and Rand Paul doubling down on the Benghazi conspiracy charges. We'll play that little clip for you. I thought he did ask some pretty good questions last week, and that was a little bit of a debate because the headline after all of that came out and said, you know, protect Israel at all costs. And I think a lot of people are a little confused by what he's saying, and maybe we'll get you to break that down here in a minute. I'm not sure if you heard it, but I will play some of the clippage from that. I want to talk more about North Korea, but since we're talking about, you know, budgets for defense and budgets for state, have you interpreted or looked into this whole issue of sequestering these budgets? Do you know what that means? And is that something you can explain to the listeners?
No.
It's a big deal. This is one of the things that Kerry was asked as they were putting him through his hearings. And let's remember Alan Dulles was Skull and Bones and head of state at one time. And maybe that's exactly what we're getting with John Kerry. I'm sure he will aspire to that. What it technically means is they're going to start analyzing the budgets a little bit more and cutting. It's a threat to cut and not give them more money, as they do every year. And when we hear Obama say he's going to cut, and we hear this crazy talk about, oh, my God, they're going to cut the Pentagon's budget. How will we defend ourselves? Which is a joke. By taking our guns, of course. We're going to defend ourselves. But what really happens, as you know, James, is that is a bottom line budget that constantly keeps going up. So it's not going to go up as much next year. This is really all they're promising. It's still going to go up. It's still going to be more than the next, 20 countries combined. I thought you might have more insight into that. Let's go back to North Korea. Wouldn't common sense say, like Iran, that North Korea couldn't nuke anybody without literally committing suicide?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a foregone conclusion that it would be a suicide maneuver should they ever attempt it. But once again, they're not even at the point in terms of miniaturization of their nuclear warheads to even be able to fit one on an intercontinental ballistic missile, assuming they could even get one to America. So again, it's a theoretical upon a theoretical upon a theoretical. It's one of these things that is nowhere near the realm of reality. And yet, again, as we talked about recently on my program when you were on, we were talking about the EMP idea and how this is being hyped up with North Korea as this imminent threat. And I think it's just interesting to see the uptick in interest in North Korea as a potential boogeyman for this Asia-Pacific region, because I think they might still be floundering around trying to look for the appropriate boogeyman to sort of introduce this theater of operations to the general American public, where, you know, they always need to present that simplistic, dumbed-down caricature of you know, the enemy that they can just dangle in front of people and be the excuse. So I think North Korea fits that to a T, because it is demonstrably headed by a madman and is just the most absolutely monstrous state on the planet. I think there's little doubt about that. So it certainly fits that, and their ability to actually pull off a nuclear attack at this point, I would say, is laughable. I mean, the farthest they could probably reliably get it is Pyongyang, and even then, I mean, what's going to happen? I don't know.
I mean, it is a militarized state. That is certainly always going to be a threat to somebody. It seems, though, that I'm not giving Kim Jong-un, the son of Kim Jong-il, much credit here. I think he's just sitting and watching TV or whatever while all this is kind of like Obama. He's just cutting ribbons and stepping and fetching for the most part. He's more of a puppet even than maybe Obama is. But what I'm getting at, though, is that I've noticed this for years, that North Korea is pretty apt at playing the United States and playing the West like a fiddle. They start putting out press releases and doing fake missile tests and whatnot, and they always seem to be rewarded for it, James. They always get some more money, or they get something for doing that to go back to bed for a while. I know the Bush administration was pretty good at throwing money at the problem.
And yet the one interesting thing about this latest round of fear-mongering, and the one thing that might be potentially different, is the fact that China is not necessarily playing into it. And they, in fact, voted in favor of the UN Security Council resolution to condemn the satellite launch last month, and that imposed a couple of more sanctions on a Hong Kong bank and a couple of North Koreans. Again, it's probably not going to do anything in the long run, but it's still at least symbolic, considering China tried to block the last such attempt at a resolution at the Security Council in 2010. So this could be a change, and of course we're all trying to read the tea leaves, as it were, to try to find out where this new Chinese leadership is going to take China, and whether they are maybe looking for a different way to situate themselves in this six-party talks or whatever they're going to come up with for North Korea this time. So this could be something slightly different. And on that note, I was just noting that there's the latest APPF meeting, the Asia Pacific Parliamentary Forum, is going on right now, and China's top legislator Wu Bangguo is making a speech about how there needs to be closer parliamentary cooperation amongst the Asia Pacific nations. So again, we're all trying to figure out which way Xi Jinping is going to take China for the next 10 years, and who knows, maybe China's looking to try to change their standing in the region and maybe make more friendly with some of the players here. So who knows at this point, but it could be one direction that this could all go in.
Well, on that note, how much influence does China have on North Korea?
I would venture to say it's probably pretty much total. It's between China and South Korea are the two main lifelines for North Korea, without which even the state such as it is could not possibly exist. I mean, it is a state that is kept up with food aid and with economic ties, and most of the economic ties are with China. So it is pretty much just a complete puppet state that's being propped up by these governments. And I think everyone's just afraid of what would happen if all the lines were severed, and it would probably just lead to the deaths of millions of people who are, as we can see, probably already on death's doorstep anyway. So it's a horrific situation to think about how this could actually be resolved, barring some sort of military invasion.
Well, let's keep in mind that North Korea is under sanctions. The people, of course, are being massively punished over there, and that's how sanctions work. And they do generally lead to war, as we saw with Japan, your home country now, in World War II, that they were really kind of forced through sanctions and economic warfare to do something. And so we got to always be kind of careful with that kind of economic diplomacy, let's call it. You know, what's interesting is that, James, I interviewed David Frum, the author of the Axis of Evil speech, in which North Korea was mentioned just after 9/11. And that was, I think, in 2002. And I had mentioned to him, you know, he was very pissed off at North Korea. We've got to do something. They're going to nuke us any second if we don't do something. Keeping in mind, that was 11 years ago now that he said that. And I had mentioned to him, well, why is this our responsibility? Why isn't China pick up the do here, and why don't they do something, and if they want to be part of this so-called world community? And he literally laughed in my face and told me how stupid I was, that China has no influence on North Korea and can do nothing, and that we have to do it all. Of course, he's been completely discredited as a massive neocon, in fact, even turning on his own party here in recent years. But I guess in the end, I was right.
Yes, but to be fair to him, at least he was being not hypocritical in the sense that all of the other neocons are being hypocritical, where Iran is the pressing threat to humanity and the fact that they may one day perhaps develop a nuclear weapon sometime in the future, whereas there's already a nuclear-armed state that is constantly at least putting these threats out, whether or not they'd ever be able to follow through with them, and it gets barely a mention in the back page of the newspaper. So, I mean, there's quite a bit of discrepancy going on there, and hypocrisy, of course. So at least people like Frum were being completely non-hypocritical in the way that they fearmonger over everything and try to use it to their advantage.
Their equal opportunity fearmonger.
Exactly.
Not to give David Frum any credit, he also wanted to nuke Iran back then as well. So he's pretty consistent, at least in that regard. Speaking of Iran, we're with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. He's with us the last Monday of every month. And, of course, we in turn do his show once a month, which I'm really very honored to do. We hear this morning in some of the headlines more saber rattling, Israel warning of a preemptive strike on Syria. I mean, really? And They're demonizing Ahmadinejad. Again, he's saying uproot Zionism and kill all the Jews. That's allegedly what he said. We don't think that's the truth. And Henry Kissinger, still around, still working his magic around the globe. Iran nuclear crisis could be close. Key facility, they say, might have just been hit. So it looks like here we are just days, literally, actually less than 24 hours into the official constitutional second term of cousin Barry Obama. And here we are looking at multiple more wars on more fronts and more global catastrophe. And of course, in his so-called speech he gave from the podium when he was unofficially being inaugurated, he said the wars are all over. 10 years of wars are pretty much all over. I can't see it looking worse. How do you break down what's going to happen in Syria and what might happen in Iran?
I still think that the Iran strike has to be some while off yet. I don't think it can be that imminent. And I don't know. I suppose it certainly could happen this year. But I am definitely looking for something in Syria to happen first. Whatever is going to happen, I think it would happen in Syria before it reaches Iran. And we'll have to see the way that that plays out. There are a few options on the table. As you mentioned, now Israel is ramping up the rhetoric. And apparently they've deployed their Iron Dome anti-missile system along the northern border, along the border with Syria now, and they're threatening to do something, you know, to prepare for the threat of a chemical attack from Syria, so, as they're saying. And this is coming exactly as some new documents have been hacked from a UK defense contractor called BRITAM, which apparently they've had their emails hacked, and one of these emails is supposedly somebody, one of their sources is saying that the Qataris have proposed to fund a plan that they say have been has been approved by Washington to smuggle chemical weapons into homes, and they would be Libyan origin chemical weapons that are similar to those that Assad would have to deploy through some of their assets. So the obvious implication from this email, again, take it for what it's worth, it's a hacked email, and there's no way to really verify this at this point. But if this is true, it seems to be an indication, once again, of possible false flag chemical weapons attack to be blamed on Assad. So, and again, this is not the first indication of that plan that we've had. We had that that strange video come out a while ago from that group that of Libyan terrorists saying, we have the chemical weapons, and they did a experiment on a lab rabbit and which died in the video, and all of this weirdness going on around chemical weapons and the red line and all of this. So I think that's very, very much on the table. I think that's the most likely option of sparking a change in what's going on in Syria right now. I think they have to do something to try to change the status quo if they're going to want to actually invade the country. So I think the chemical weapons false flag is, unfortunately, one of the most likely scenarios I could see for the near future in Syria anyway.
That sprouted up here, what was that, about 2 months ago? And I want to just put a little historical context to all of this, James. We remember one of the main reasons when it all was whittled down, we know Saddam wasn't behind 9/11. He wasn't supporting al-Qaeda. He actually hated them. At least that's most of the information that we can see. Eventually, they had two excuses for going in to Iraq. One was that, well, remember the WMDs, but then that failed. And later they started giving these excuses. And one was, and this relates to Syria, that we were going there to, you know, save them and give them democracy. And the other one was he gassed his own people. And we remember this story about how he gassed the Kurds. And that this is the kind of a tyrant, and of course we should know, we trained Saddam Hussein, this guy was. But in fact, when I talked to Stephen Pelletier, who was the CIA station chief in northern Iraq at that time, he said that he didn't think Saddam Hussein was behind it at all. And maybe this was just kind of a way to edge us closer to attacking Iran. Sorry for the long question, but he said Iran most likely was responsible for that, for gassing the Kurds. Now, what we don't hear in the media, James, is that northern Iraq is really having almost a little civil war up there with the Turkmen and all the different factions trying to get control of the oil fields up there. So I don't know, you know, I think there's quite a history for this. I don't know if they can get away with saying Assad is going to gas his own people or not. I guess maybe with as dumbed down as people might be, maybe they will. But the ultimate question is, why is it taking so long? Because they sprouted this whole idea about, 2-3 months ago.
Well, that is a good point, because of course false flags are only effective if they're not expected. And once they are expected and they've been well talked about and written about, I would say that the ability to use them goes down dramatically. So if they tried to do something at this point, obviously there's quite a bit in the alternative media already about, you know, exactly what they're planning to do and how they're planning to do it. So I think there would have to be some twist in this, something that hasn't been expected yet, in order to try to sell it to the public. But maybe I'm putting too much faith in the public. Once again, I mean, this is the same public that's been led into war after war after war based on lie after lie after lie. So perhaps at this point they realize that there's a certain percentage of the public that's willing to go along with just about anything. And that's worrying. But on the note of the Iraqi chemical weapons attack on the Kurds, I would be interested to hear about how that there might be information pointing to Iranian involvement, because I'm familiar with the story and I'm familiar with the types of narratives that have come out about that, but I haven't really seen what kind of evidence there is for Iranian involvement in that. But it would be interesting to hear about.
Well, you'd have to get it from Stephen Pelletier, and his story is out there. He's been on our show. Again, this was 10 years ago, telling this story, and I thought it was really important, considering that was one of the main reasons we were allowed to go in. We were saving the people of Iraq. And of course, remember Rummy and the rest of them saying they were going to throw flowers at our feet when we got in there. So, you know, well, the rest, as they say, is history. You know, the other thing, I guess, is that what I've been hearing, at least from people like Hillary Clinton, is they're really desperate to get Russia's help and sanction and approval before anything bigger happens in Syria. What do you think the possibility of that is? Because maybe people haven't noticed, they've pretty much gone along with all the other attacks. They've either, like China, abstained and not voted on the UN Security Council, or they haven't stood in our way and done much about these this growing imperialism, I guess.
Well, but again, keeping in mind Libya was pre-Putin, or at least Putin was not in the presidency as he is now, so there might be that difference.
No, he was controlling.
He was certainly behind the scenes, yeah. But there is the theory that Medvedev kind of diverged from Putin towards the end. But regardless, at any rate, I honestly can't even imagine how such a turnaround would occur at this point. I think Russia has quite definitively come down on the side of Syria, and I don't see how they're going to back away from that. I remember about a month ago there was much being made in the Western media about some comments that one of the Russian top Russian officials had made about how it's possible that we could foresee somehow Assad would crumble, or that the Assad government would cease, or Assad would stop being president, or something along those lines. And that was immediately touted in all of the Western press simultaneously as, oh, Russia is backing away from Assad, etc., etc., when really it was nothing of the sort when you actually investigate the quote. So I think that type of quote mining is certainly going to go on, and they're going to try to create this impression that Russia might be, you know, diplomatically arm-twisted into going along with this. But I don't know. I honestly think this might be a line in the sand. If not, then that's a good indication, if there ever was one, that this is completely 100% a staged, you know, standoff between Russia, China, and the West, and that it's just going to fall into line and be war after war. But we'll see. Again, I'm willing to be corrected on this, but I just don't see that happening.
And then let me just throw my two cents in, considering a correction, if you like. But you know, one thing we do know is that, first of all, Goldman Sachs has an office in Tehran. I mean, we need to get this out to people. And I've talked to some of my financial experts who say that they think that Goldman is some really telling Iran what to do. They're listening and consulting with Iran on a lot of these issues. And these sanctions are broken all the time. So that's the other issue. But also, there's a Nathan Rothschild office in Moscow. And I know that the popular belief is that, you know, Putin is some anti-imperialist, he is some anti-globalist, and he goes after these guys because we saw the change of hands with all the wealth of Russia. But I'm not sure that's really true. And the fact is that if they want to use an economic weapon, there's so many of them they could use against Russia. Russia, I'm sure, is more than happy to make oil deals and oil price deals and some kind of a deal to go along with whatever the West seems to want to do, as long as it's not, you know, pointing things at them.
Well, it's certainly, that's a good point. There's a few schools of thought on this, I guess. We could look at it that way, or we could look at it as if Russia and China are playing the long game right now, and they're trying to see if they can actually start the formation of something that would be viable as an alternative, not necessarily in the near term, but in the long term, to be able to resist this. So that might look like concessions here and there, where it might actually be strategic consolidation of power and resources for a longer term gain. And I mean, at this point, we've already seen, for example, how Russia has the switches that it can throw to basically throw Europe into a deep freeze in the winter when they want. They haven't really used that power very much yet, but it's certainly something that they have up their sleeve. And with Nord Stream and South Stream coming online, it's definitely something that is, yeah, it's kind of an ace card up their sleeve for a future scenario should that develop. I don't think there's any doubt that at the very core, this is all part of one connected network of people who are bought and sold and paid for by the same banksters who have the same agenda, and that's global government. But I still think it's up in the air whether or not there are factions that are vying for that global seat of the throne.
Well, I mean, look, I'm not going, you know, where I want to go. I try to go where the information leads me. And one thing I always try to keep in mind is that we're always told there's this national sovereignty, that the Chinese are doing this or the Russians are doing that. And meanwhile, there's a Henry Kissinger type that's working deals with all of these people and controlling them like puppets. And so I always try to, you know, get that perspective to my listeners and put in that possibility, James, because otherwise we get involved in these nationalist world war scenarios. So I think it helps people understand that this is a grand chessboard. This is a game. And China, we can talk more about that in the next segment if you like, James. But China, we're fighting them in proxy wars in Africa now. We really are fighting them and going in and doing regime change in Syria, likely because of China's influence. The same thing with Libya, same thing with Iraq. So this economic warfare that really is ground down behind all of this, obviously in Mali. I want to get to this in a minute when we come back, because we know that there is uranium mines, there are gold mines in that part of the world, and that both countries, China and the United States, are vying to control those. And I want to ask you about this. The Belgian MP, Laurent Louis, I don't know if you saw this, but he's a member of parliament in Belgium standing up and giving a speech against the war in Mali, exposing the entire war on terror and 9/11, using 9/11 truth, and basically telling everyone else to F you. Did you see this speech that he gave?
I did see a few minutes of it. I saw it was posted up on Deadline Live, so I was watching that. It is certainly a refreshing speech to be hearing that in from a politician. It almost seems like what you would imagine a politician should be doing in an age of such insanity.
He's like a Ron Paul over there or something, and he's probably dead by now. But we'll cover that when we come back with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. Stay with us. This is the Jack Blood Show.
People are sad, and I know why. With no chance to live before you die, you get pretty sick if you have to keep it inside. I wanna build a house where an ad don't scream. I wanna live in peace, quietly. I wanna have a place of love and safety. People ought to live how and where they want. People ought to have respect in front. People ought to get along pretty okay. So get off my dick. I'm building it brick by brick. Brick by brick. I'm building a house where I can think and have some balance and dignity. I'm building a house where no one can hurt me. I'm building a house where the weak are strong. I'm building a house with a real song. I'm using a faith that is immortal. I'm building it with simplicity, and the way that we feel, you and me. I'm building it with what I believe in. So get off my dick, 'cause I'm building this brick by brick. Brick by brick. I want to be true to my simple heart and not put nothing else above it.
Well, a little speech about incrementalism by the godfather of punk rock, Iggy Pop, Brick by Brick. Thanks for being with us today. It is the 28th day, Monday, 2013. I'm Jack Blood, your narrator, your radio gun. As always, you're listening to No Agenda Global Radio and affiliates. James Corbett is with us today. He joins us the last Sunday of the month, every month, and we're very happy to have him. James Corbett, thecorbettreport.com. You can go check out his podcast there. Please contribute, because he works the same way I do, value for value. And if you don't donate to his cause and keep him going, there won't be any more Corbett Reports. So you guys have done a great job doing that, and that's why he continues to grow. So thank you for supporting my friend James Corbett. James, we were talking about geopolitics in the first segment. It really isn't as confusing as it sounds, is it? I mean, we're trying to read the tea leaves here and look into the future. That's always a little tough. To explain how this all works does sound a little complicated, but I don't think it is quite as complicated as maybe we made it sound or people make it sound.
I think you're right. I mean, at base, this is just easily understood through basic human motivations and psychology, etc. Of course, with the added kink in the equation there, that of course the people at the very top of the system are psychopaths and function absolutely nothing like you or I or most of the people that we know, and can't really be accounted for through that psychological analysis. But but once you get that in there, I think that all starts to make sense of what's really going on.
And they use double speak and double think and all of this, so that's what makes it kind of complicated. You got to peel off all the layers, but when it comes down to it, we know what the end game would be. Well, that would be to synchronize the world and the economy and everything with it under one umbrella. A few guys make all the decisions, to completely centralize everything. And that's really what it's all about, to control everything and everyone on the planet, all of the resources, and to keep the decisions as centralized as possible. That's why I always tell people, if they want, I know we're going to talk with G. Edward Griffin Wednesday about this, but if you want to solve this, you simply do whatever you can to decentralize and repeal and do things on the local level. I just heard Cynthia McKinney is going to be running here in Georgia for the Saxby Chambliss seat. He's retiring, and so I'm going to help that if I can, because I think she would be good for Georgia, even though we don't agree on some economic issues. But that's something that will be better, because she's going to ask hard questions of our leaders if she's in the Senate. I do declare Saxby Chambliss is done. That's how he starts every sentence. Speaking of asking the right questions, did you see Rand Paul in both the Kerry hearings, or at least the clips, and the Hillary Clinton grilling? About Benghazi?
I saw a bit of the Hitlery Benghazi grilling, but I must admit I can only stomach so much of Clinton and her face and voice and what she says, so I turned it off pretty quickly.
We had actually a little comedy clip we posted on our Facebook. I was trying to find it. It looks like it might have disappeared, but it was some senator being as obsequious and up her butt as humanly possible, not even asking a question, but praising her for her hair and her mannerisms and just how great she is. And then he runs out of time before he can ask her a question. Rand Paul did ask some pretty tough questions in the Kerry hearings, I believe, was when he said we funded bin Laden and created Al-Qaeda, and that, you know, talking about the blowback involved in all of that. In the Clinton hearings, he talked about gun running out of Benghazi, and maybe that's part of a cover-up and why we're not getting something anywhere near the truth of what did actually happen in Benghazi. He doubled down on the Sean Vanity show, and I've got this one-minute clip. I want to play it and tell me what you think of Rand Paul and this idea. Hold on. Here it is.
Without question, there was a political cover-up. Without question,
why?
Though, there's
why
an
do you
absurdity.
Think that is?
Well, I asked one question. I got one question in towards the end of my period, and I said, were we involved with selling, buying, or procuring or transferring arms to Turkey? I think arms were being sold and have been sold out of Libya to Turkey, and they're winding up in the hands of the Syrian rebels. I think they did not want to draw attention to that. That may have been occurring through the CIA annex. I don't have proof of this. No one's given me any information. I have no briefing to this. But there have been articles in the newsprint and in the press saying that there was some gun running going on, and I think they wanted to get attention away from there and say, oh, it had to do with something like a movie to draw attention away from. Maybe it had something to do with a gun running apparatus or a gun running organization that was happening right in Benghazi.
Good job today, Senator. Thank you. And yeah.
Well, yeah. Was it a good job? It almost sounded like he was discrediting the whole idea while he was talking about it. What do you think about that, James?
Well, at least he's bringing it up, which is more than can be said about a lot of the people who have got that media spotlight. So I guess that's something. But absolutely, I think this is the hidden part of the Benghazi story. And I was just writing about this in the International Forecaster last weekend, where basically I think this has gone through the kind of five-act play theater version of events where they've talked about there was the spin, the initial spin, and then the counter spin and all of that. And then finally we've got this hearings, which is just going to wrap it up, and they're going to come out with some recommendations for improving embassy security or what have you. And it's basically right. That's going to be the end of that. But it is important that we at least interject these points in while there's still a bit of spotlight on this, because absolutely, I think what was going on at the CIA annex, whether it was related to what Paula Broadwell was talking about before she got nabbed in that whole affair scandal, where she was talking about how the CIA was operating a prison there, and that's what the protest was about, or whether it's related to the gun running, that we know that one of the people, at least, who was killed in that raid was involved with gun running in some way, was certainly working for intelligence. So we know that the intelligence agencies have their fingerprints all over what was happening in Benghazi, and we do know that there was a ship that was seized in Turkey around about the same time, and I can't remember the exact details off the top of my head, but there was a ship that was seized in a port in Turkey almost the exact same time as the Benghazi incident itself, which was full of guns that were on their way to Syrian jihadis, and this was conveniently covered up when they started talking about this video that came out of nowhere.
Yeah, that's more important than saying Turkey. Yeah, this, yeah, and he did say that during the trial, and I thought, or the hearing, sorry, should have been a trial. That is more important, that stuff is going to arm the next Al-Qaeda, or the new Al-Qaeda now, or whatever Al-Qaeda is, and or the next terrorists that are going to attack us in Syria. That is important, not to mention the fact that I don't like how he says, I don't have any information, I don't have any proof, but I've been reading it in the news. I mean, you read the news, you find whatever proof there is, and you bring that up. You don't say, I read it on the internet. That just seems almost like either he doesn't know what he's doing, or he's almost discrediting the information as it comes out. And by the way, I still feel that Hitlery and the neocons pulled that in cost-benefit analysis to damage Obama's foreign policy credibility, because I don't think she wants Obama in the next 4 years. I think that hurts her chances significantly of being president in 2016.
Well, notice how they framed that exchange between Paul and Clinton. In the next day in the paper, some of the headlines were talking about Clinton versus Paul. Is this a preview of 2016? So that's the kind of headline that sends shivers down my spine, and not in a good way.
which maybe portrays Paul as having some kind of an agenda. They also said, I would have fired you immediately, when the bigger story was, you know, we fund Al-Qaeda. That didn't come out in the headlines.
No, that's just a side thing. We don't have to talk about that. No, of course, that's the number one thing that has to be avoided. So again, to the extent that he was attempting to bring that up, I guess that's to his credit. But of course, that's not what the headlines are going to say.
I've got a story on my site right now, James Corbett, The Corbett Report. Please check him out, his podcast, his radio show, his blog, thecorbettreport.com. That's with two T's, and it's not Corbett, it's Corbett. He's the first and the best. Homeland Security training TSA workers to save themselves, and they're doing some drills in airports here on what people, even some TSA people, might be saying could be a government staged shooting at an airport. Have you seen this story?
I have seen it. From what I understand, this comes from a Washington Times article, a Mooney Times, as you say, article that was sources back to one whistleblower on the inside, and it's not even clear, even if the whistleblower can be relied on, the anonymous source, it's not clear if this is an agency-wide thing or just something that's part of the airport that this source was working at. So a lot of sketchiness on this, but certainly it does fit into the MO of what they're looking for and what would certainly serve their agenda, because this would tie a lot of loose ends together if they could get some crazy guy that's mad at the TSA to go shoot up a bunch of people. That would certainly put a bow and a ribbon on a lot of the things that they want to bring in, and even stepping up what the TSA do.
Well, it's been suggested that this is going to be a problem reaction solution scenario to get guns in the hands of these TSA screeners who are not cops. They're not trained to, I mean, look at all the scandals with the TSA over the years, from child pornography to smuggling drugs to you name it. They've pretty much done it, stealing out of people's suitcases. They are really nothing more than low-level Walmart employees that decide to go work for the federal and government. You just look at them when you go see them. Is that even likely that these guys are going to be carrying M16s, or that it will be more military-style police at our airports one way or the other?
Well, I'm not even sure if that's the issue so much as whatever the next round of technology they're trying to bring in terms of screening and scanning and databasing and fingerprinting and biometrics and whatever else they want to throw at people. Because, of course, they've just done that recent kind of, oh, we're going to retract the X-ray body scanners, and but they haven't really. And it was only on a technicality because they weren't able to meet certain requirements beforehand, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's these types of ebbs and flows to what the TSA is doing, where they kind of attempt to, or they want it to make it look like they're retreating when in fact they're advancing. So I could see if this type of thing happened, it would certainly play into whatever agenda for whatever next technology they wanted to try to force down people's throats in the name of safety.
Total biometrics at the airports. You know, they were testing in Halifax, I guess Canada, years ago, a lie detector kiosk that you'd have to go through before you can get anywhere near airplanes. And you'd have to, you know, just like when you come across the Canadian border, you'd have to tell them where you're going, who, what number, where the phone numbers of the people you're going to. If they start asking you these questions, you got to provide them all, except the lie detector kiosk measures if you're not telling the truth, if you're sweating, if you're nervous, and then you won't be able to get on a plane. Total massive biometric prisons if you want to travel, and that's certainly one of the benefits. And then, of course, the people that sell that stuff, as you just mentioned. Here is a little clip of TSA Phoenix Airport, a freeze drill scare tactic. I don't know how this is going to come out over the air. Yeah, you got to... I'll just explain it.
Stay right where you are.
Freeze. So these people are standing in line at the airport. The TSA officer, everybody stop. Stay right where you are. All right, now go ahead. So they're kind of conditioning people with this. Now what's interesting is in the Washington Times article, they talk a lot about Kurt Haskell, which I really like. I'm really glad that they did that. And he tells the story of the underwear bomber. As we know, Kurt's been on the show many times. Most of our listeners are familiar. He was a witness on the airplane for Al-Matab and the underpants bomber. And what he had said was he was sure, after his research and talking to people, and he was excluded from the trial because Al-Matab pleaded out for a life sentence, held underground for the rest of his life, never talking to anyone again. Why anyone would do that, I don't know. He, of course, he said that the FBI gave him Elmatov the fake bomb in order to, again, move forward this restrictive security industrial complex. That's interesting that the Washington Times would include his version of events, I thought.
It is, and I'm racking my brain. I just recently saw another interesting story on the Washington Times that wasn't the kind of thing you would ever expect. So I'm wondering if they're trying to move further towards the conspiracy side. But of course, no one in the Beltway, I think, really takes the Times seriously anyways. So that's maybe not going to change anyone's minds.
Yeah, well, there's that. No, because the Post is the Bilderberg, Washington Post is the Bilderberg paper of record. Haskell says in the story that the airport is the perfect place to set up and stage a play, such as a false flag event. So we've got the entire story at deadlinelive.info. I couldn't get into it for the sake of time today. We found out also today that the NATO protesters are seeking to overturn the state's terrorism laws in Chicago. They were charged for massive terrorism. And the NATO 3, remember first they were the NATO 5, but it turned out two of them were actually FBI agents dressed as black bloc anarchists who had infiltrated these groups, these activist groups that were going to speak their mind inside the perimeter at the NATO conference in Chicago in 2012. I think we all remember that. It turned out that these guys, attorneys are saying, the guys were not going to throw Molotov cocktails. They shouldn't be charged for terrorism. That whole charge should be overturned anyway. And the fact of the matter is they found a beer kit and they raided all these houses, which they've done all over the country before these events come in, James. They go in and do preemptive raids, unconstitutional, no Fourth Amendment raids, kick down doors, confiscate books and clothing and anything that could be used to prosecute and hold people and get them to incriminate themselves. There goes the Fifth Amendment. Beer brewing kits. Terrorists now, they could have used that beer kit to throw a Molotov cocktail. These guys have any chance at all? Or we saw that the Houtari beat their case, so there is hope.
I think so. I mean, it might take months or years, but eventually it'll, once it's left the news cycle, then I think they can safely discard of it when no one's looking. But I'm just reading from the story posted up at Deadline Live right now, and the involvement of infiltrators has led the attorneys to suspect that the FBI, Secret Service, and Chicago Police Department were all involved in an entrapment scheme. No, absolutely not. I can't believe that.
Well, I can't either, especially considering they do that every time.
Every single case for the last decade.
The Federal Reserve bomber, all the rest of them, they are all infiltration. The 93 World Trade Center bombing, infiltrated by the FBI, given a real bomb, replaced the fake bomb. Let's not talk about that, though. That's just a big conspiracy theory. Oh, no, that's right. It's all documented. Have you been covering or investigating what's going on up at Davos here last week and this week? Are you getting any information out of that? I lost a lot of my good contacts back in the day, and we've been trying to figure it out.
Well, I haven't got any contacts there, that's for sure, but I am going to keep my eye on it. I'm going to go through a wrap-up of basically what happened there, and that's going to be my next International Forecaster editorial, so people can stay tuned for that this Saturday.
In my opinion, CGI is more important and has bigger people involved in it. That's the Clinton Global Initiative than Bilderberg. And I think Davos is bigger than both of those. Bigger, I mean, it just doesn't get much attention. And, Joan Vian used to go there for us, and she'd tell us, she'd go sit in the meetings and talk to people and tell us exactly what their plans were, whether it be global warming. I think if we look at Obama's speech and his agenda for the inauguration, I think we're going to see most of that being discussed at Davos. But there's Henry Kissinger in a back room holding court, and a lot of young sycophants coming in wanting to be part of this, ready to do anything it takes to carry out these guys' agenda.
That's the key to it. It's not Bilderberg. It's not the Clinton Global Initiative. It's not Davos. It's the little, cliques that meet in the back room, afterwards or between meetings. That's where the real thing happens. And again, it's the Bilderberg Steering Committee, or it's the people who are really at the heart of this. And the one-time Bilderberg invitees, or there's thousands of attendees at Davos. Of course, they're not all, part of the upper elite. It's just those key circles that are manipulating it. So it's not the event itself so much as the key players that we see that we can track that move from event to event and are the ones that are obviously pulling a lot of the strings, like Kissinger, unfortunately.
I got tons of more questions, but we're almost out of time here. We got about three more minutes. I have dominated the interview for the entire hour. Anything you want to bring up that I haven't gotten to? I know you're working on any number of investigations and projects at CorbettReport.com. Anything you want to put in that I haven't talked about?
Well, I just want to let people know I'm doing a series for the Boiling Frogs Post eye-opener reports that I do, the video series that I do every Tuesday. I'm doing a series of reports on organizations of influence that don't get as much attention as Bilderberg or groups like that. So I've done, for example, Royal Institute of International Affairs. We just did the Zionist Organization of America. And tomorrow we're going to be talking about the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. So I'll be continuing that series. And also later this week, I'm going to be interviewing Sibel Edmonds. We're going to be getting more into Operation Gladio and how it never really went away and how that's at the core of her state secret privilege case, which has never really come out yet. So hopefully we're going to get even further into Sibel Edmonds' case, and I'm going to have a podcast episode kind of wrapping up some of that information this Friday. So I hope people stay tuned to CorbettReport.com for that.
We'll investigate how Gladio has been updated into things like P2OG and how that could be behind this psychological warfare attack on the American psyche and with these public shootings. James, I really think there's a connection here. We've heard the whistleblowers talk about how they weren't afraid to kill children to advance their agendas. Sibel Edmonds, of course, the great 9/11 whistleblower. The reason I've never had her on is because guys like you do such a great job with her. I can just replay that on the show if I need to. So give her my best, and boy, is she something else. And so are you, James Corbett. Excellent job on the show today. I really appreciate it. CorbettReport.com. Go support them. Keep them moving forward. Have a good one, James.
You too. Talk to you soon.
All right, folks. Second hour coming up on the Jack Blood Show right after this.